Scott, one of my running partners is Tailwind Nutrition.
It's your probably most reliable partner, I would think.
Well, you know, you said it. I'm glad you said it, and I didn't.
You know, Tailwind Nutrition recently posted something on Facebook that I want to reiterate. They talked about, let me read it verbatim, and then we can discuss among the table.
I'm sure Tailwind carefully crafted the message, so let's hear it.
I assume that Jenny composed this tweet.
Sorry, Jeff.
Yeah. My email box is getting littered with 20%, 30%, even 40% discounts. At Tailwind Nutrition, our philosophy is quite simple. We don't believe in artificially inflating our prices. We don't believe in special promotions every month. We don't believe in confusing or frustrating you, our customers. We do believe in providing Tailwind at a fair price, day in and day out. And most importantly, we believe in keeping you and your stomachs happy.
If you were starting a company completely ethical and driven to provide benefit and value, wouldn't you pick a price that worked for everybody, worked for the business, and worked for the customer?
You know, I work in sales,
mm-hmm.
and consistently, my customers are saying, "All I want is your best price day in and day out. I don't want to have promotions. I don't have to deal with that minutia." Know that when you go to tailwindnutrition.com, you're getting a fair price and a great product, and it works.
So go to tailwindnutrition.com.
Are we recording?
Dr. Romanoff, you're probably very experienced at professional interviews. This is not one of them.
Oh, come on. Don't put yourself down.
we are very casual. That's a good word.
Ashley, were you expecting a professional podcast?
No, I wasn't. Apparently not. Sorry, guys.
Yeah.
And it was a miserable, miserable day.
Welcome to another edition of Trail Runner Nation. I'm Don Freeman.
I am Scott Warr.
And I am the Southern California correspondent, Jimmy Dean Freeman, with the newest addition to the podcast, Baby Banff.
Is Baby Banff a Southern California affiliate as well?
She's the newest Southern California field reporter.
An intern.
She's an intern, for sure.
Do we have to pay interns?
No, not at this point.
No, she's not on the payroll yet. She has to earn her keep.
She doesn't have a social security number yet.
She does, actually.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they start them early these days, Scott.
They want to start collecting early.
It's not when you get your first lawn mowing job anymore. It's when you take your first breath. They already want a number on you.
Yeah.
Hey, today's guest is a unique guest, a guest that we've never had on before.
A non-breathing guest.
We have, as our guest, we have Ultra Running Magazine, Volume 1, Edition 1, May 1991, as our guest.
81.
What did I say? 91?
Yeah, 81.
Dial it back 10 more years.
34 years ago, first issue.
Jimmy, where were you 34 years ago?
34 years ago, I was in Clayton, California, at the base of Mount Diablo. And I was approximately 5 years old, so I was probably only running about 30 or 40 miles a week.
How about you, Scott? Where were you in 1981?
1981, I'm sure I had an 8-track blasting Van Halen.
Very good.
Somewhere.
I was a graduate in May 1981. I was graduating high school back then.
Wow.
Back in the day.
With a mullet? Did you have a mullet?
I wasn't rocking the mullet, that's for sure. So somewhere on social media comes a link to the PDF for Ultra Running Magazine. And I was lured into it and started reading and was fascinated as I turned the page.
And if you are fascinated as we were, you'll listen to this podcast, of course. But we're going to link the PDF to the podcast notes. So if you actually want to go back and look at some of the stuff we're talking about, the PDF will be in the podcast description.
So today in a lot of Ultra Running Magazine covers, we see trail running. We see beautiful background of a mountain range with a runner. Here we have on the cover Bill DeVoy in 1980, the TAC or TAC 50-kilometer championship running through what looks to be like a New York.
Looks like Central Park.
Central Park. So lots of runners out on the road taking up space. Nothing like we're used to today.
And I should note, Ultra Running Magazine back then was a bargain price of $1.50 per issue. And just to give you an idea, 34 years later, Ultra Running Magazine, still a great deal at $5 an issue.
You know what? I think we should do an analysis because I think it's still about 2 gallons of gas that will get you a magazine or you know, if we use gas as a measuring stick. So
or
I think
leader, that's where you're buying that gas, Don.
Or liters.
So, you know, another thing that I thought as I turned through the pages and came across, they did a great job of listing different races that are available. And we didn't have Run 100s back then where you could just go online and download all the upcoming races. How did you find out about this stuff?
Al Gore hadn't invented the internet yet.
True. Hey, and you know, back in 1981 or around that time, I created a flyer and I had to go to a typesetter to have him put out a... It's true.
It was only a couple of years since the printing press was invented. Is that what you're saying?
No, but the typesetter was... I mean, it cost $80 to get a single sheet made. And maybe I was taking a little bit on the cash side, but he had to painstakingly go through and set the type for our little brochure that we were making.
I think you're getting old because that didn't happen in 81. They had Xerox machines in 81.
No, we could copy it, Scott. But how did you set it up? You didn't have a word processor.
Oh, okay. I understand.
Stay with
good
me.
Good point.
So,
but similarly,
yes,
ultra running has come a long way in the last 34 years. I was looking at the same thing, some of the races. They were doing race announcements in there, right now, you go to Ultra Running Magazine and see their calendar, and it's probably 5 or 6 or 7 pages long with all of the different ultra runs. This only had, I think, 2 or 3 pages. Most of the races that are on there, entry fee, $2.
Yeah,
entry fee, none.
We're going to go through some of those things. Take a listen to this. On the Front Runner 24-hour run, it's a track run, and it was held in... we're in Tower Hill Road, North Kingston, Rhode Island. Here, pre-entry only, limited to 24. If more than 24 enter, the 24 with the best credentials get to run. So you can be bumped if a stronger runner comes. Out you go. What do you guys think of that?
Isn't that what they do at Western States now?
No, they don't do that.
It's tough if you're a first-timer. You have no credentials.
Yeah. Ah, well, you know, maybe you're supposed to get out there and run some other races before you get into a 24-hour track run. But what if they did that today with runs? What if they did that with some of your premier Leadville or Western States?
Best credentials, huh?
Yeah. You walk in with your resume and you can bump the lowest guy off. Any thoughts on that, Jimmy Dean?
Well, I mean, the Montreal Ultra Cup is a way for them to make the field more elite without bumping anybody. So I think that's kind of become the best of both worlds, where you can make it a competitive field and not eliminate how the race got started in the first place.
Queen's Day 100 miler, 44 times around a flat 2.7-mile paved loop.
Ouch.
Yeah.
How much was the race the race fee for that?
They're not even sure because they put in parentheses, date and time are tentative. So
that's hilarious.
They've got the location, they've got the number of laps around the track, but they're not sure when it is. Edward Payson, Weston Memorial, 6-day, quote, go as you please race.
Huh, interesting. Yeah. You know, they have the Old Dominion 100, which is one of the oldest 100 milers. Back in 1981, it was $50 registration. Today, I believe it's around $165.
35 miles of backwoods trails, 55 miles of dirt roads, and 10 miles of low-traffic blacktop. 7 major climbs. That's the Old Dominion. You ran Old Dominion, didn't you, Jimmy Dean, on your 100-mile quest this summer?
It was the first 100 in the summer series.
$50 back then, and it said you must have a handler. You ever seen that in a race these days?
It's not a pacer, it's a handler.
You have to have a handler.
They still call it that at Old
Dominion.
Oh, do they?
Do they really?
Yeah, because the horse race still happens on the same day.
Huh. Hey, Jimmy, do you know whether
I'm sorry. At Vermont, they call them handlers. Old Dominion, the horse race happens 1 week apart.
Oh, okay. Do you know if has the course changed?
It has changed quite a few times.
Okay. So is there more trail and dirt than there was back in 1981?
There's precious little pavement, blacktop. Hmm. It's mostly country roads and single track Massanutten and Mountain Trail.
If you're in Baldwinsville, New York, you could have run the Hannibal 50 miler. The course was a tartan track with water and toilets close by. Entry fee, $2. Hey, this is only 34 years ago. We're making this sound like it's in the 1800s or something. Entry fee, $2, and you must have a lap timer recorder. No pre-entry needed. Just show up with your money and slap it on the table, and you can do it.
Is that the one that says you should wear an analog watch so you can keep track of your time?
No, that's down below here. You can run the Tarzan Brown Cross Rhode Island Run. The course is paved roads, and there are no fees, no awards, and a low-key run. That's how it's advertised.
So the Laurel 50-miler, but that was an expensive one back there. It had a $5 fee. And it doesn't say $5. It says the fee is about $5.
Jimmy, I'm on page 15 as we're under ultra running calendar now. And Western States Endurance Run is advertised here. The course is described as up and down and up and down and up and down, dot, dot, dot. So there's your course description. The field is limited to 250. Limit for 1981 was filled in August of 1980. So, no, if you want to run that, you better get on it. It's not like it is today when there's one in a million chance of getting in. So we've got some great races, but they also list a great number of race results. The magazine has asked race directors to send in their results, and then they posted them. And back to my comment earlier about typesetting, as I look through this, it looks like somebody on the typewriter going through all of this stuff. This was not easy back in the day. So as I look at a couple of these race results, there's some names that you might recognize as the Alameda County Perimeter Run held in Albany, California, 100 miles, held February 22nd. There were 9 starters and 2 finishers. John Notch was 32, and he finished it in 2045. And tell me if you've heard of this name, Dick Collins, who's 47, Dick Collins Fire Trails is out here. So we end up seeing some names that still are out on the course 34 years later. How about this? The Mississippi 50-mile run finished 19th. Gary Cantrell, who was 26 years old at the time. You know that name from Barclays
Marathon.
That's right. So as we look back and see some of the our forefathers in the running here, we see them listed. How about this one? The Potomac Valley Senior Track Club, the Senior Track Club, and which is a bit disheartening for me, and Jimmy, maybe for you, because you fall into this age category. Robert Harper, who won in the Senior Track Club, was a whole 31 years old. So 31, and how about this? It looks like there was 5 finishers, 1 DNF, and you don't want to be listed this way. Paul Robertson was listed at a finish of 5:55, but they put right next to his name, walked. He walked. So that might discourage you from putting walking as part of your strategy.
That's funny. You know, the one thing that I found very comical, maybe not comical, just interesting on the back, is an advertisement. There's only, I think, one advertisement in the whole issue, and it was the New Balance. The New Balance shoe. It wasn't a trail shoe. I don't think they had trail shoes back then. It was the New Balance 660. Mm-hmm. And its main marketing attributes were that it was less weight, more protection. Only 9 ounces.
there is an additional ad in there, just one, and it's about the size of a business card, and it was for the Boda Belt, a proven winner at Western States 100 miles.
It's a Boda Belt.
And it looks to be like just a strapped belt that a trail runner's best friend. The Boda Belt lets you carry a quart of water or other liquid snugly, almost unnoticeably, around your waist. I don't see a straw on it or a hose on it or anything. I guess you just take it off and open it up and start swigging. Have you ever seen a Boda Belt, Jimmy Dean?
I have.
Really?
Yeah.
In a museum or someone yeah, actually using it?
It's a more common item for hiking.
I know what a Boda bag is. Skiers use Boda bags. Anyway, so we want to get into the thing that actually caught our eye and we want to spend most of the time on is an article by Tom Emel, I guess is how you say his name. And the title of the article is Ultra Running, Beginning Steps on a New Road.
He's a runner himself. In fact, there's a picture of him in here, page 9. Scott and Jimmy, I'll draw your attention. At mile 15 in the TRA Challenge Race in Peoria, take a look at his gait. Take a look at where his foot is landing underneath his body and his posture as he's running. You know, he's doing it right as far as, you know, all the coaching we get from Dr. Cucuzella and Sock Doc and all of the our mentors as far as running gait. He was right spot on. So not only is his gait on, but we went through here and looked at some of his commentary. A lot of the things we do today has been passed forward from gentlemen like Tom Emel in this article. And so the things that we've learned on the trail that have been passed forward, this is part of the resource.
So he goes in the first paragraph and he explains what the word ultra marathon is. Which I think most everybody, it's almost a mainstream word now. Even people that aren't runners, I think, know what an ultra marathon is.
Jimmy, have you found the popularity of, or the at least recognition of what ultra marathoning is has increased, or do you feel in your observation that it's still a niche group and somewhat obscure?
Both.
All right.
That's a good answer, Jimmy. Yeah, thank you.
It's increased tremendously in the last 10 years, but it's still there's still a large percentage of the population that hasn't heard of it. And, you know, over the summer, I bumped into a friend who wanted to introduce me to a physician. And this physician was in, you know, retirement. So he was an older gentleman, I would guess like early 70s. And he seemed like a really sharp guy. And he said, "Oh, this is my friend. He's in the middle of running a series of 100-mile races." And the guy looked at me very squarely and said, "You know, how many days?" And I said, "Well, it's a continuous effort, usually around a day. I'd like to finish most of these races in less than a day." And he said, "Oh, by the time you do your third one, your knees are going to be gone." And I was like, "Well, that's interesting because I've already done 3 in the last 6 weeks and I've got 3 more in the next 5 weeks. And it'll be my 17th, 18th, and 19th run of at this distance." And he just stopped for a second, dumbfounded. And the very next series of questions was from pure curiosity. Like, "Tell me more about it. How do you maintain yourself? How do you keep your body from breaking down? How are your knees not like?" He went from this like know-it-all physician who had never even heard of the sport and basically a cautionary tale to, you know, fascinated. And it just illustrates that there's still a lot of people out there who have never heard of our sport. And at the same time, you know, there's the sport is booming comparatively, you know, from the time I did my first ultra in 2005 to now 10 years, it's been a rapid ascent. I mean, there's, I think, like 10 times as many events. It's pretty wild.
And that says a lot for that physician that you were speaking to. It's nice that, you know, he has an open mind and is, you know, willing to listen and explore the possibility. That's nice. Sometimes people, when they get around 70 plus, might not have such an easy opened mind. So that's a good personality trait.
So one of the things in this article is, you know, he's basically telling you what you need to do to run your first ultra. So he gets into, you know, things to consider before you enter, the training that you should probably do leading up to. And he specifies like the 50 mile distance because he thinks, you know,
that's a good place to start.
It is. A 50K is very similar. 50K training is very similar to a marathon training, but 50 miles is a little bit different. And kind of goes through that, goes through the diet, what to expect in your first 50 mile run, the equipment that you need to use, what to eat and drink, that sort of stuff.
And I think the first piece of information he gives about running base is really important. And he extends the notion that we need to make sure we have a decent base. You just can't decide one day, you know what, I heard, you know, another runner did a 50-mile or, you know, 100K run. I think I'm going to go do that. He suggests that to enter a 50-mile race was preceded by at least 6 months of 50-mile weeks, providing that base. And I think that's good, solid advice.
So my question is has the philosophy changed in the last 34 years? Would you agree with that today?
Well, I would say that you know, this is one man's opinion, and what the general philosophy of the whole community. I'm not sure, can't speak to that. But to this point, I think that's sound advice.
Let's get another man's opinion. Coach Jimmy is a coach. Jimmy, if someone's trying to run their first 50 miler, would you agree with Tom's suggestion here 34 years ago?
Not at all.
Okay, what would you suggest?
I think it's completely unique to each individual. Okay. I think that some people can jump into mileage and handle, you know, more consistent mileage. And for one person, you know, they might already be averaging 60 to 70 mile weeks as a marathoner. And, you know, so 50 mile weeks would be too little. And for someone else who maybe they've run one marathon and they're drawn to a 50 mile event, but their body can only handle, you know, 40, 45 miles a week, and then recovery weeks of 20, where they're averaging like 35, 40 miles a week, I don't think that precludes them from finishing a race of 50 miles.
Hey, Jimmy, I like what you just said about run a 40-mile week and do a recovery week at 20 miles. And I think so often we start putting our plan together and go, okay, I need 40-mile weeks or a 50, you name the number, and you stick to that and don't allow yourself some flexibility between weeks, a 40 and a 20 and then a 50 and a 20. I think that makes good sense, allowing the body to recover a little bit from the long week.
And as a interesting side note, my training program for the original 600s last summer, from early February to late May, I averaged 47 miles a week.
Mm. Yeah, you had
so
some.
I didn't even run 50 mile weeks for 6 months to do 600s in 13 weeks.
You had some long weekend runs in there, though.
I did. But he's saying you should run 50 mile weeks for 6 months to be able to finish your first 50 miler, and I don't agree with that.
Okay. I think you made a good point. And another kind of along that weekly training cycle that I wanted to bring up that I think is interesting to look at is weeks do not need to be 6 days or 7 days. You know, you can have training cycles that are 10 days long or 15 days long. You can divide them up differently than just what the calendar dictates. And so I think that's something to consider for variety and what works for you, and everybody's a little bit different. I think the bottom line comes to learning to listen to yourself and listen to your body and listen to your feet, your calves, your knees, your hips. What are they telling you? Can you go long? Do you need to shorten up? Do you need to make your training cycle, you know, a 40 mile week, and you better drop it down to 20 just so you can freshen things back up? I think that's the dynamic type of training variation or variety that you need to have.
I agree. You know, one of the things that I thought was also interesting is he quotes Arthur Lydiard, mm-hmm. Mark Cucuzella talks about Arthur Lydiard quite a bit, and his groundbreaking book, Running the Lydiard Way. Lydiard.
Under training, another very proactive approach to body maintenance. He says, preparation for an ultra marathon should not neglect upper body development. This becomes a significant factor late in the run. And I would say that is key. So many times we just focus on the waist and below of slogging out the miles or getting the miles in or doing the hill work or doing the speed work or however you want to classify that. It's still lower body work, and strengthening the upper body can help make a well-rounded athlete. Jimmy, you're involved in some upper body work workouts?
Total body workouts.
That's what I meant.
Squats, a little bit of yoga, core strength, posterior chain strength.
How has that changed your running, Jimmy?
Well, prior to doing anything like that consistently, about halfway through pretty much every ultra run distance, I would say to myself, God, I wish I did more core work. As my, you know, stomach hurt and my lower back was sore. And as I ran more and more miles in the mountains, I started to develop more imbalances. And that led to some low back problems, some piriformis and hip flexor issues. At one point, right before I started training for the original 600 challenge, my low back froze up in December, and I was supposed to pace at North Face, and I couldn't even do 5 miles. So at the beginning of that program, I couldn't do 5 miles. I could barely get out of bed. So I had to really get into serious about strength training to correct some muscular imbalances. And as I got really consistent with that, I found I was fatiguing later and later in the run, mm-hmm. and, you know, feeling better throughout, and it's just helped a lot of things. Over the summer, you know, I didn't ever feel like I broke down.
So upper body strength development, absolutely critical. I think you need to become a full body runner, just not a lower extremity runner. So well stated, Jimmy Dean Freeman. Scott, your next topic that you've been looking forward to and anxiously leaning forward to talk about.
You know, he talks about diet. I'm curious how diet has changed in the last 34 years. What he says here, which I don't know whether I've ever heard since I started trail running, and then maybe that's because I don't have this issue, but he says it won't hurt to gain a couple pounds. You'll retain more water, which you can use. Besides, you'll burn about 5,000 calories on race day. So do you ever tell your students, Jimmy, to gain some weight?
I tell them not to worry about weight. I tell them that strong is better than skinny. And, you know, I've trended up 15, 20 pounds over the last 5, 6 years. And some of that's been a little extra body fat, and some of that's been strength gains, but I'm more worried about the time on the clock, less worried about the number on the scale.
Yeah, I agree with that. I would rather be strong and then skinny. I think if you go too low, I think that's what Matt Fitzgerald, racing weight, right? He wrote racing weight.
Mm-hmm.
There is that right weight, fighting weight. You know, it doesn't say that the lightest guy wins every race. You need to be strong too to have the muscle to bring you through the hills.
You know, one of the things that he brings up here in his point two under diet is camel up.
Never heard that term.
Camel up, which he says weeks before the race, you need to drink lots of liquids. I don't think I've ever heard that.
I think that's a very dangerous proposition.
I think so too.
That sounds like a great precursor for washing out your electrolytes and hyponatremia.
You know what? Washing out your electrolytes. I learned that lesson. I was it only happened to me on race day, cramping early on races. I never cramp by mile 15 on any training run. How come on race day I'm starting to feel these cramps? And it was exactly that, Jimmy. I wanted to make sure I was well hydrated, and so I overindulged. I drank fluid until, you know, there was no more drinking fluid, and there wasn't electrolytes in that fluid. And I think I washed them out, and I started cramping early in ridiculous spots that I had no business cramping by 10 o'clock in the morning on a race. No way. And I think it was just that, washing out those electrolytes. So if that's a good piece of trail knowledge, at least it fit me.
Don't superhydrate the day before a race. If you're peeing every hour and a half clear, you're drinking too much.
Yeah. And I worked hard on that.
You know, some of this stuff has come full circle. We've talked about some of even in recent years how things have come full circle from minimal, maximal footwear. Here's one that I thought was very interesting. He says, forget about carbohydrate loading. Okay, and this is back in the 80s, which I think was kind of at the heyday that you know marathoners were carb depleting, you know, weeks or a couple weeks before their race, and then carbo loading, you know, right before the race. He says it won't work in a 50-mile run. You can't possibly store enough glycogen for that distance. You're going to have to ingest carbohydrates early in the run and rely upon the ability of your body to burn fat as fuel.
Mm-hmm.
How many podcasts have we done about the Maffetone method of getting your body to efficiently burn fat?
Sonny Blende's message, become a fat-burning machine.
Tom was way ahead of his time.
Yes, he was. Absolutely. He was pointing us forward, and I think that that's one of the things I found most interesting about this is we are not going back and ridiculing or making sport of the information written here. As I was reading it, I was thinking how spot on so much of this is and how we are rediscovering some things some of these guys were doing in 34 years ago. Here's one that I thought, and if Kate can hear this, or she may be able to shake her head and nod, as I know she's in the room over there, Jimmy.
Kate's actually gone out on a run.
Is she good for her?
Yeah.
You're going to have to ingest carbohydrates early in the run and rely on the ability of the body to burn fat as a fuel late in the race. Women can do this more efficiently than men. If they ever come to believe that, underlining believe, ever come to believe that, they will probably become very competitive in the ultras. Huh.
When was it that the first lady ran the Boston Marathon and kind of got pulled out? What year was that?
I don't remember. I don't know. I know the story. Do you know Jimmy?
The girl is Catherine Switzer.
It was in the 80s, wasn't it?
No, I think it was 70s.
Okay. So this is still not too far removed from that time when
the dark ages.
They thought that that women could not run marathons.
Well, bad for the uterus.
He's saying once they figure it out because they're more efficient fat burners, they're going to be competitive at ultra distances.
The original women's Olympic marathon was 84.
So not too far.
1967 Boston Marathon.
Hmm.
60s were close to the 80s.
Yeah, really close.
What to expect in your first 50-mile run? Now, this was the next heading on there. Somewhere around 30 miles, it starts to bring you down physically. Later, it attacks you mentally and starts working on your confidence. Well, now, if there wasn't ever any more truth than that, it starts physically, and probably that order. You know, he stated in that specific order. You know, something kind of breaks down on you physically, and that attacks your mind and your position, your mental capacity or position, and then your confidence goes away. You need to protect those, and so I think the dominoes do fall in that order, and that's why we have to take care of ourselves physically to keep the rest of the dominoes standing. In my metaphor here.
Yeah, I think most of this stuff in this topic are right on the money. He says you should probably get some experience running alone because in these ultra distances, you're going to be, you know, and most of us have run these things where, you know, it's a conga line or a big grouping of people. But by the time, and a 50-miler especially or longer, you may be doing a lot of alone running.
Assume that you will do some walking. The trick is to plan your walking and then adhere to that agenda. Expect to be very impatient with the walking segments early in the race. You will feel fresh and strong, and you will want to stop running once you have started. Never mind all that. If you're planning to walk, walk. And I think that's some good advice. You have all kinds of energy. You've probably tapered a bit of in some sense, and so you feel your legs are fresh, you have a bib on, you're around friends, there's enthusiasm, and your plan was to walk, and you throwing it out the window and said, I don't need to walk, I'm feeling so great. He goes on later to say, you will pay for that and wish that you had. And I think that's a lesson that we learn over and over.
I think in the article somewhere he says something like, don't go out there and kill it for the first 25 miles and walk the last 15.
Right. Don't succumb to an ego trip and run for 35 miles only to walk and stagger for the last 15.
My math was a little fuzzy the first time. Sorry about that.
I just give
you... Hey, Jimmy, I have a question for you. He says right here for a 50-miler time, what to expect or how to calculate what you should be finishing a 50-miler, your first 50-miler. And he says, take your last marathon, double it, and add 2 hours. Would you agree with that?
I think it depends on the course, but I think that's a good starting point for a first-time 50-miler.
Thank you.
I always used to say double. I used to say double the distance, triple the time.
Double the distance, triple the time. Yeah, that's a good one. And there's some good guys out and gals out there that have done the analytics on that and put it in the old Excel spreadsheet and looked at AR 50 and seen and determining what you would do at the Miwok 100K in Western States. I know there's a whole theory and logic behind all of that, and it turns out pretty close. And I don't know if we willed ourselves into the categories that were selected or if in fact it's true. Concentrate on your form. The same good running posture you maintain in shorter races is critical in a 50-miler. Bad form is very fatiguing, and its effects are magnified over time. So I think that's also a piece of trail wisdom, that running gait is critical for efficiency, running efficiency. Again, Dr. Cucuzella's theme that running from point A to point B can be done most efficient with proper form. And so Tom mentioned that early on as well.
You know, I'd like to get into, you want to continue on that topic, but he talks about the equipment you should use in an ultramarathon. I thought this was actually kind of funny. Of course, he talks about a pair of sunglasses. He talks about suntan lotion.
Mm-hmm.
When was the last time you heard the word suntan lotion? It's all sunblock now, isn't it?
Oh, that's right. That's a good point. Yeah, I liked where he said, make sure that the sun, I can't find the exact reference here, it should have some sunblocking quality.
Some?
Yeah, I think that's pretty good. You ought to have that.
And even back 34 years ago, it was important to use Vaseline or a petroleum jelly.
Well, and if you read deeper, he says you can lose some of the advantage of the petroleum jelly because it wears out. Be sure to get some Kramer Skin Lube. So they're already working on realizing that chafing was something that could slow a guy down.
I've never heard of Kramer Skin Lube.
Yeah, I've got
Is that
some,
still around?
I think Two Toms. Is that Kramer stuff? I don't know. I have to take a look. But he says, do not wear a jock strap or cotton underwear because there is not enough Vaseline to prevent chafing in that case. Jimmy, a jock strap. I mean, I don't know if I've ever heard of an ultra runner jock strapping up.
I actually wear a dancing belt. It's like a jock strap, but you don't put a cup in it.
Oh, really?
You do wear that?
Thong, 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 thong.
Can you post a dancing belt, Scott, on the show notes, please?
I've never even heard of a dancing belt. I don't know if I want to go to a website that sells dancing belts.
He says, put some ice in your hat. Now, that's something that is practiced regularly. Yeah. He says, it may sound strange, but do it. It works. And Jimmy, does that work on a hot day or what?
Ice in the hat, ice in the bandana on the back of your neck. Keep the head and neck cool.
It's gold, I'll tell you. It makes a world of difference, and having it drip down steadily down your back and wherever it might go is a wonderful experience on a hot, hot day.
What about racing flats? He talks about shoes. He says, racing flats are for races. In your first ultra, wear the same training flats that you use in your over-distance runs.
Mm-hmm. Socks are optional. He's worn socks, heavy sweat socks, and he's run some 100K without socks.
I want to get a roundtable discussion on that. Have you guys ever run without socks? Jimmy?
Yeah.
And what did you think? Do you recommend no socks or socks?
I'm a sock guy. I like socks.
I have not even tried no socks. I would be afraid. It just sounds to me like a recipe for blisters.
You almost tried running a 100-miler without socks.
No, not intentionally, but I would never set out without socks.
It's different, too, on the roads and the trail. Trail, you get a lot more debris in the shoes.
Yeah.
But people do it.
Wear a chronograph so you can check your pace once in a while. I had to Google chronograph. I didn't even know what the heck we were talking about.
You know, that's one thing that has changed quite a bit, you know, from a watch that had a timer on it.
Yeah, so
to now, what the thing that you have on your wrist right now, which I don't know what it can tell you.
This Garmin GPS, the 920 XT, is that what it is? It tells me pace, cadence, how much vertical oscillation, how much of my head's bobbing up and down.
How much time you spend touching the ground.
Yeah, all that stuff. Well, a chronograph, as I looked it up on Google, because I just didn't have one. They're those cool-looking like aviator watches with those little dials, little, and so you can set that and watch that 60-second thing roll around in there.
I think
kind of like a stopwatch.
They also had digital watches with timers back then.
Well, he says get one of these. And okay. So I can't do that kind of math deep in a race. I don't know how I would even operate that watch.
My math gets better deep in a race.
You don't realize that it's really awful, Jimmy. I've seen you try to do the math.
No, you haven't. I'm good.
So let's talk a little bit about food and drink. And he says, as far as I'm concerned, unless you're planning to be running longer than 8 hours, you can forget solid food. A light breakfast of toast, juice, and coffee ought to hold you until your next meal, which will be after the race. Trying to eat anything more substantial than a little fruit while you run may cause problems. The time to experiment with food is during training. Never experiment with food during a race unless you are prepared to drop out because of an idea which simply didn't
that
work.
That is a rule that has not changed.
Mm. What, experimenting
never
during
never experiment with new stuff on race day.
What if you're about to throw in the towel because all systems are down? Then I say, hit the emergency, pull that lever and try anything. Because if you're about to bail out, you might as well try something to rescue you. Jimmy, have you ever tried anything new on race day?
Yeah, there are certain things that I say you can get away with. New and but general rule is nothing new on race day.
Mm-hmm.
But when you think about it, like your first time you run a marathon, you've never run past 20 miles. That means the last 10K is all going to be new. Calorie plans, you've never done calories for that many hours in that format. That's going to be generally new. I generally get a new pair of socks. But it's the same type of socks I've trained in, but I get a new pair of them for race day. That's new. But anything radically different, you're playing Russian roulette with your race results.
Jimmy, I don't know. Maybe it's a Freeman thing. I get a new pair of socks, mm-hmm. too. That's the thing I treat myself to on race day, a new bib and a new pair of socks. But everything else has been proven on training or other races. I like where he's going with the conventional wisdom would say knocking down great quantities of sugar drinks, with some being shelf items and others home brew, is something that had been done a lot. And he said, and I'll paraphrase in there, this is page 13 for those following at home on your copy of edition 1, May 1981. He says that he was in a race and his legs were shot and he was continuing to drink the sugar drinks and then went completely away from it and went into more of the fruit juice. He had he supplemented with some calcium lactate and some raw adrenal concentrate and vitamin C. He put this thing together and he said,
what?
Well, I'm just reading the thing, page 13.
I don't know
13.
What that is.
You go to your health food store,
okay.
Ask them for that stuff. They'll give you a bag of things. And he said his legs repaired. It felt great. Took about 20 minutes for everything to get back online, and he was in great shape. And he says enough. He says the controversy about sugar drinks is over in his mind. He's going towards this type of nutrition approach.
I know when we talked to Gordy before, he used to use watered down grape juice.
Mm-hmm. He still carries those bottles of orange juice bottles, old school. And we've talked to Dana Gard and some of the guys that were running in this day. And they didn't have the Ultimate Direction kicker top going. They were carrying mustard that you could squeezable mustard in this and the syrup containers.
Aunt Jemima bottles.
That they could pop that top and squeeze it in.
Yeah.
So things have come a little ways. The after effects of a 50-miler. So he's going to give us some what happens after you've run these things. You will go downhill mentally during the last 15 miles of your first ultra marathon. And then you will get as high as a kite just before the finish.
That has not changed.
I don't think that'll ever change. There's times that You go through the ups and downs more than the hills. Like we talked about the Western States course, up, down, up, down. Your emotions kind of follow that up, down thing. And there's always, it's not the same for everybody. And I think that's how we help hold one another up. There's times when you're feeling in a dark place or down that the other guy or gal that's running past you is feeling up. And how often do you hear, hey, how you doing? It's a tough spot. You'll feel better. You'll be passing me soon. And because we all realize that it's just a symphony of ups and downs, not only on the trail elevation, but also our mental, you know, position or where we're at. So, Jimmy, are you have some comments on up, down?
Nope. I've got nothing to say about that.
It's just true?
True.
Some people have been known to become a little crabby a day or two after one of these races. And it's probably only fair to warn your family in advance that such behavior is not unheard of. Without fair warning, they may be totally taken aback by your attitude. And I think that's some pretty good advice. Hey, I may be crabby. I just want you to know this may not be, the race may not be as hard as you dealing with me after the race. So that's something we have to keep in mind.
It's true. You know, and then he gets into kind of looking into the future. You know, where is ultra running going? Mm. And makes and I think it's probably could be written in Ultra Running Magazine May 2015 as well. Mm-hmm. He says that this is never going to replace, ultra marathoning is never going to replace baseball or football as America's best pastime, or soccer if you're in other areas of the world, or football, I should say. Football in the other areas of the world. It's a relatively small group of people that participate in these events. And I think that's still the case. It's still a small segment, although it has grown considerably since 1981.
What also hasn't changed is he's found these things out, some of them the hard way. Some of them passed on to him, no doubt. He didn't find all these themselves, but he took the time to write them down, took the time to share them and craft them and make sure that they were accurate to the best of his knowledge. And he closes with this sentence. When you decide to run your first ultra, the best wishes of this writer go with you. I mean, that's
ultra running right there in a nutshell.
Yeah, that's the spirit of the trail and the spirit of fellow ultra runners, and know that to be true, that we all wish good for one another and support one another and help one another learn. And that's what we're grateful for a lot of the podcast guests, you know, Jimmy and the whole list of them. They have that same opinion.
And I'm grateful for Ultra Running Magazine. I mean, they started back in 1981 sharing these articles and information and products that are coming out that help us do better. Back in 1981, a year subscription, 10 issues, $10. Mm. Actually, I don't think it was 10 issues back then. It was less than that.
No, they said 10 issues. Your one-year subscription costs $10 and brings you 10 issues and sent by first-class mail.
And now those 10 issues cost still a bargain rate of $49.99.
They encourage race directors and unsolicited articles to be sent to them. That's they were calling for information. But as you look through here and go back to the beginning when I talked about typesetting and the work that it took for that person to put down all of the type and the font and putting it in the right direction. I look at this work and they put a lot of effort into this. And hats off to the original team that provided this document for us. It's nice to see that information continues to flow.
You know, so I think it was fun to go back and do a little reminiscing and looking. I mean, this is many, many years before I started running. And what's fun is they have, I think, most of, if not all, the old issues available at ultrarunning.com.
I would encourage people to go to Ultra Running Magazine, take a look at what they're doing today. Scott and I are both subscribers to the magazine because it has value. I get on a regular basis emails updating me if the magazine isn't around. I get updated on what articles are new and fresh and important, and many of the things that we talk about and opinions that we form come from just exposure to good information. So I would encourage folks to go out and look and see what they're doing for the sport and continuing to do for the sport. Jimmy, any closing comments on historicity of ultra running?
What was that word?
I don't know.
Did you just make up a new word?
Nah, I think it's a word. Anything to share with us, Jimmy? Be careful with the words you choose.
It's fun to watch the sport evolve and watch some of the baseline principles be passed forward of, you know, sort of the sharing and community-like feel of this particular sport. You know, people are out there to help each other out for the most part. And it's why I keep coming back.
Nice. Now, Scott.
One thing that has not changed is like we talked about, the community, the attitude, the sharing mentality of the sport. I think that if you were to transport in a time machine back to 1981 to Old Dominion 100 and be at the finish line to see the elites back then and the people that were finishing back the pack, they're both still very approachable. You could still sit down and get advice from those people, and they're willing to share. I think that is one of the beautiful things that has not changed, that has been a consistent fundamental of the sport.
Siri, define historicity. Let's see if she can do this. It appears to be, historicity is a historical actuality of persons and events, meaning the quality and being of part of history. Look at that, Scott. I didn't invent a word.
Accept my apology, Scott, Don. I am so sorry.
In this particular case, Don is being savant. It's not intelligence. It's accidental knowledge.
Hey, every squirrel gets a nut. You know, even a blind squirrel gets a nut.
That's why I was certain that he was wrong, because I know Don.
Gosh, you know, sometimes it's better to be quiet and remove all doubt. What is that saying? It's best to remain silent than to open your mouth and remove all doubt.
It's better to be silent and thought a fool than open your mouth and remove all doubt.
That's the reason why we invite Jimmy, is because he is the man that has more quotes memorized than anyone I know.
Jimmy, thanks a lot. I'm glad you uphold the last name Freeman and provide a little balance. There's balance in the universe, and you're on one side, and I'm clearly that counter force. So, Trail Runner Nation, go check out Jimmy's Coyotes. They're running wild in the Southern California hills. There's trail runs that they help organize, and Jimmy's coaching. If you need you need a coach and know more about how to do what he does, and he has the information to pass along.
If you're visiting Southern California, get in touch with them and go on a run with them. They can do that, can't they, Jimmy?
They have. Many Trail Runner Nation people have traveled to SoCal and come on a Thursday morning trail run with us.
Right on. So we encourage you to do that. Go out.
Now, you guys, we're surviving a very harsh winter. I just went for a run in 84 degrees. It's very, very harsh.
We're sitting in February, by the way, for those of you who are listening to these podcasts in archive. February 2015, 80 some odd degrees in Southern California.
Well, it's you pay a tax for that, Jimmy. You don't get to enjoy the wonderful winter sports with snowshoeing, cross-country skiing, and that type of stuff.
Follow Jimmy on Twitter. What are you, Jimmy? Coach Jimmy?
Coach Jimmy Dean on Twitter, Coach Jimmy Dean on Instagram, CoachJimmy.com, CoyoteRunning.com, InspiredRunning.blogspot.com.
You got a full-time job just updating your social media.
We are pumping out content in every area.
Go out and pump content.
Mas.
Scott, do you have something you want to share with us about the new website?
Yeah. Go to TrailRunnerNation.com. We had the Ninja working feverishly for, I think, about 19, 20 months on this new website.
Yeah.
And it is clean. It is easy to navigate. It just has it's nice.
We're proud of it.
We are.
We like looking at it.
And Tim Smith has done just a phenomenal job. He took a little bit of a break at aid stations to work on the website, and go check it out. Easy to find the podcast, easy to find the store, easy to follow us on social media. Go out and look at it.
You know, in Tim's defense, he's not a slow worker. We're just a little bit slow at getting him the information that he needs. If you need some website development work, I'd recommend take a look at our website and go catch Tim's link. And knock on his door and see what he can do for you, because the guy's just there's not very much there that's our ideas.
Yeah, if you're running a business that needs a website, go to the Contact Us button. Just send an email via that, and he'll get it and
let you know what he can do.
Yeah.
Does great stuff. So go out and get some web stuff done.
Moss. Don't tell them how you found me.